It used to be that if you wanted to communicate with your friends or family or acquaintances, that you had to send it by a written letter and send it by a human messenger. But things have changed. Isn't that wonderful? I think about it when I fly on a plane. I think about it when I go on the interstate. I think about it now when we can just send off email messages quickly to missionaries. In other words, we live right now in the legacy of human ingenuity. Things maybe that we take for granted, but that ingenuity now we are the beneficiaries of. It used to be, women, not very long ago, that you couldn't vote. It used to be that those of a different skin color were slaves of men in this country of other men. It used to be that there were limited religious, political, land-owning privileges. It used to be that way. But because of the legacies not only of human ingenuity, but the legacies of human sacrifice and endeavor, now we have freedom of assembly. We have freedom of religion. We have freedom of suffrage. We are living in a certain legacy now, benefits that we enjoy, that at one time a people did not enjoy. We have the benefit of goods and services, which even Solomon himself did not know. We are able to go to the grocery stores now and have our salads already prepared. Men who would have to go out into the jungles and far places, people that would have to gather in the kitchen for hours and hours, and now we have salad dressings that Solomon never tasted, drinks that never went down his throat, goods and services. We ourselves have more servants and slaves to us in this present age than Solomon ever enjoyed in his. Even the poorest of us have benefits and legacies. The legacies of human enterprise have fallen to us, and we are the beneficiaries of them. Changes have occurred that in a certain sense we take advantage of or even have forgotten. Well, why am I mentioning all of this? Why highways and email? Why freedoms and liberties? Why goods and services? Why this talk of legacies? Because, dear beloved believers, we ourselves possess and live under a legacy that men of old did not enjoy. It is the legacy of a direct and a lasting access into the presence of the living God. We live in the midst of it. It is like we fly on our planes and we think nothing of it. We drive on our highways, we send off our mails, and we are enjoying the prerogatives and privileges of those things, those endeavors, those legacies. But beloved, we have a far greater legacy. A far greater change in history has occurred than just simply human innovation, invention, enterprise, endeavor, and sacrifice. It is the work of God through His Son, the Lord Jesus Christ. And in chapter 7, verses 11 through 19, he sets forth for us our legacy. A great change has taken place. It is the greatest change in history. It is the most needed and excellent change in history that ever occurred. If men were to be able to come into the presence and enjoy assurance, access, and fellowship with the living God. We enjoy it now. We don't realize what it was like. Some of you don't realize what it was like to get into a 1964 Parkwood Chevy station wagon without air conditioning and go across Barstow on a two-lane highway. I remember what that is like, and now when I don't have to do that, and I go in an air-conditioned car that won't break down and doesn't have burlap bags in the front to keep it from overheating, and Stuckey's all the way along the way. Some of you remember all these things. See, we see how old you are. You say, what is he talking about? Isn't this the way life has always been? No. Well, isn't this the way Christianity, isn't this the way true religion has always been? No. Beloved, we ourselves as believers are living in a legacy which in a certain sense the writer to Hebrews chapter 7 says, I want you to understand, it was not always this way. You have a privilege that those who themselves, you look back and consider themselves as privileged. You look back at Abraham. You look back at David. You look back at those who had a glorious faith, a great faith and a glorious hope. I want you to understand, beloved, no matter how great their faith was, no matter how wonderful their hope is, that you yourselves, on account of the event of Jesus Christ coming, being crucified and risen, you have a better hope than they did. You have a better access than they did. You have a direct and lasting access, and I want you to understand how it all came about. In other words, don't take this legacy for granted. And he's setting it forth. You see, we don't have a sense, even as I prayed, we don't have a sense. We're not the Jews. We didn't live back in the days before Christ. And we didn't just live as maybe children just growing up and watching these men in their impressive vestments and robes. We didn't watch them as they would take all of the animals and hear the bleating and the crying of animals and see the slitting of throats and the spilling of blood. We didn't see the blood-stained garments, the blood-stained altar, and all of that. We didn't see the prayers. We didn't see the incense. We didn't smell all those things that were in their face all the time. We didn't see the court. We didn't see the door. We didn't see the veil. We didn't anticipate and wonder what was behind that veil, the mercy seat and all of those things that represented the presence of God. No, we come as those who live in a modern age, the age of liberty and freedom. But we have a spiritual liberty and freedom which God has given to us by His Son. And this is what He opens up in verses 11 through 19. The most wonderful change in history. I want to open up this text this way. You know, he began in verses 1 through 10 and he just simply said, listen, this Melchizedek, the order of Melchizedek, there's a new priest coming. And this priest is greater than the old priesthood. But now what he does in 11 through 19, it says, listen, this priest is not only greater, this priesthood replaces it. It replaces it. A new change has come about. I'm just going to speak about this change this morning. Try to use it in very simple headings, and I hope it will be plain. This is the challenge of this text, is to make it plain and to make it understandable. But it's a glorious text. First of all, this change, which we are the beneficiaries of, was absolutely necessary. This change was necessary. Verses 11 and 12. Verses 11 and 12. This is a necessary change. Now if perfection was through the Levitical priesthood, for on the basis of it the people received the law, what further need was there for another priest to arise according to the order of Melchizedek and not be designated according to the order of Aaron? If there was perfection, if that old priesthood, that old order, that old ceremony, that old ritual, those old patterns, those old buildings, those old sacrifices, if those things were enough to bring about perfection, then why in the world did God Himself speak of another priesthood according to Melchizedek in Psalm 110:4? If that was enough, then why did God say there would be something else? The implication is that it is not enough. It was not enough. There was no perfection through the Levitical priesthood. He declares it even explicitly in verse 19. Not in terms of the priesthood, but in terms of the law. He says, the law made nothing perfect. There is a deficiency. There is an inadequacy. There is an insufficiency. There is a problem with that old order, a fundamental deficiency. And if there hadn't been a deficiency, there wouldn't have been need for another order. You see, it's the very psalm. It's the very psalm, 110:4. You see, here again, as I said, this psalm came about while the priesthood was thriving and active. While the priests were busy, while the animals were being slaughtered, while they were going in and out of the holy place, and then once a year into the holy place, in the midst of that, God said, there is going to be a new priest. And by implication, it means that the old priesthood is provisional, temporary. It's about to be replaced. In other words, it had a planned obsolescence. It was built into the very plan of God. It was built into the plan of God. But you ask, and I'm sure that it's a good question, ask, what is this perfection? I mean, what is it? Evidently, if the law made nothing perfect, if perfection was not through the Levitical priesthood, what is the perfection which is spoken about here and is mentioned in verse 19? I'll invite you to turn to Hebrews chapter 10, because I think it expresses it in the most practical terms in verses 19 through 22. This is the perfection of which he speaks. This is the perfection of which he speaks in its most practical terms. If you want to nub and tag it, it is simply access to the living God in confidence of a cleansed soul. Access to the living God in the confidence of a cleansed soul. Verses 19 through 22 expresses it this way. Since therefore, brethren. In other words, it is the conclusion, it is the application of everything that he has been saying, beginning with verse chapter 7, going all the way through 10. Since therefore, brethren, we have confidence. That's the first aspect of the perfection which we have and they didn't. Confidence! We can approach God with confidence. Why? We have confidence to enter the holy place, into the very place of God's special presence. How? By the blood of Christ, by a new and living way which He inaugurated for us through the veil, not an earthly veil, that is the veil of His flesh. And since we have a great high priest over the house of God, let us draw near. There is perfection. Perfection is being able to draw near with confidence and with a sincere heart in full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled clean from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. What is this perfection? It is the cleansing of our consciences. It is the cleansing of our consciences. They could have their consciences eased under the Old Testament, but they could never have them fully cleared. There was always the reminder of sin. There was always the consciousness of sin. Indeed, this is exactly what the writer speaks about in chapter 10. He speaks about in chapter 10, verse 3, in those sacrifices there is a reminder of sins year by year. There was no way that they could ever find that their sins were ever fully departed from them. They would look at the blood of bulls and goats and they would ask, even though it was the appointed system, how can the blood of a dumb beast answer for a free moral agent? How can the blood of a goat answer for a man? How can the blood of a bull answer for a woman? How can the blood of a beast answer for a man? And again, this was what the law revealed. It could reveal sin. It could reveal that blood was required. It could reveal that sacrifice was necessary. But all it was a shadow of the good things to come and not the form of them. And it can never, by the same sacrifice, as he says in Hebrews 10:1, make perfect those who draw near. It could never cleanse me. It could never be an atonement. It could never be a full satisfaction for my sins. It could never give me the consciousness that finally, fully, it's been done. There's been an atonement that has answered rightly and fully for the offended justice of God. And now I can come with my conscience cleansed. The blood of a bull, the blood of a goat could never do it. And so even as they came, there was this reminder that there still needed something more to be done. There was still, even as they would come with a faith and with a hope, yet still they could not come with the full confidence that the cleansing had been done. Their consciences would still accuse. And indeed, even as they came under that old system, they could not even themselves, not the husband, the wife, or the child, none of them themselves could approach the altar of burnt offering. There were men that would do it in their place, and then even some of those men could not enter into the holy place. It was a system, in a certain sense, that was designed to access, not that man had access to God, or to emphasize that men had access to God, but it seemed to manifest in all of its walls and curtains and priesthoods that men better keep a safe distance from the holy of God. It was almost an institutionalized, limited access. In a certain sense, I will establish a relationship with you by sacrifice. But there is no way any one of you dare come into my holy of holies. There will be this fusion reaction of holiness against unholiness that none of you can stand with before. So it was this system, this ceremonial offerings, the sacrifices and offerings and the whole burnt offerings, none of them would provide a full and total cleansing. None of them would cleave the veil. None of them could remove the stain that sin had made. And none of them could remove the separation that sin had brought about. None of them could give confidence. None of them could give assurance that I can come into the presence of God. They had much. They had much. But as he says in Hebrews 9:9, he says, accordingly, sacrifices and gifts were offered that could not make the worshiper perfect in conscience. He says in verse 8, the Holy Spirit is signifying this of 9, that the way into the holy place is not yet disclosed. Even as they engaged in those ceremonies and looked at him, it was just like God was just saying, listen, it's not open yet. The door is still closed. You say, well, I don't have to worry about that. I didn't know anything about that. Beloved, that is your legacy. That is the legacy. Beloved, as the children of God, we have no doors, no veils standing between us anymore. We have no men standing between us and God anymore, except one man, Jesus Christ. And what has He done? He's gone into that place forever for us. Saying what? Follow me. Follow me. It was all provisional and partial. The system, all it could do was show the holy requirements of God and remind man of his own unholiness. It could impart no life. And so therefore the writer in a most compacted statement says, perfection was not possible. He'll begin to open it up, but that's it. Something more was needed. If we would draw near in fullness and freeness and confidence and assurance and acceptance to the living God. Notice what he says, and I want to make some observations because this is his development. He says, on the basis of that priesthood, the people received the law. The priority is the priesthood, not the law. We tend to think, wait a second, it's the law that established the priesthood in a certain sense, yes. But the writer to the Hebrews understands the priority of the priesthood. He said there had to be men that would stand for you if you would ever be able to stand in the presence of God. It had to come first. There had to be mediators. Nobody could stand before the law of God unless there was first mediation. It was Moses and Aaron who were appointed first, then came the law. Yes, the law and the priesthood are intertwined. It is the priesthood itself that finds its requirements of service defined by the law, but it is the priesthood itself by which men are able to approach this God of law and be able to find themselves forgiven and freed and be able to stand in relation with Him. But it was through both of those things tied together. As far as the writer to the Hebrews is concerned, listen, the Mosaic law was not a matter of morality. That was not the main matter of the Mosaic structure, legal structure. The fundamental aspect to the writer of Hebrews of the Mosaic structure was the priesthood, was the ability of men through God's appointed mediators to draw near to God. That was the fundamental essence of the Mosaic code and regulation. In fact, notice what he says in verse 12, confirming the priority of the priesthood. He says, when the priesthood is changed, of necessity, so changes the law. You can't change one without the other. They're so intertwined. If you tweak one, you tweak the other. If you remove one, you remove the other. They're bound together. The ceremonial functions and ministry of the priesthood was at the heart of the covenantal structure. One is observed in Hebrews. He says that the writer views the law not as a prescription for individual behavior, that is how we are to live, but as the sum of the sacrificial regulations for the ancient community. In other words, the law is seen principally in terms of priesthood and sacrifice. And I think that's true. I think that's an accurate observation, the way that the writer to the Hebrews sees the law. The law in terms of its ceremonial and priestly aspects. There was a necessity, dear saints. A change was needed. And he says, if that change occurred in the priesthood, he says, then that change would also occur in the law. That's the first point. A change was needed. Verses 13 and 14, this change has taken place. This change has taken place. If that priesthood changes, there's a change of the law. He says that priesthood has changed. Verse 13, for the one concerning whom these things are spoken, that is our Lord Jesus Christ, he belongs to another tribe from which no one has officiated at the altar. There is someone serving as a priest, and it's not from the sons